From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, I like saying this.
Is the cool music playing right now?
The cool music is playing. It's winding down even as we speak.
I like that cool music.
I love that cool music myself. And the person asking about the cool music has made movies with lots of cool music in them, including the first score by Michael Giacchino. Of course, that person is Brad Bird, whose newest film as writer-director is The Incredibles 2.
Yes. It's Incredibles 2.
Forgive my imprecision.
No, the.
No, that's right. No article. So you keep the same meter. Incredibles 2. It's still four syllables in the title.
Flows from the tongue.
It does. First of all, Brad, welcome back.
Thank you.
And obviously, it's a sequel to Incredibles, and I don't want to give too much away in the film, except to say, I noticed that there seems to be a tribute to, I think, somebody who's a mutual friend, Henry Selick, in the name of one of the characters.
Yes. Well, or it could be his wife, Heather Selick, also H. Selick.
Well, Henry is an incredible animator who, among other things, did Nightmare Before Christmas, and there's a character within
Caroline,
yes, and the character is named H. Selick, who was an important mediator. But before, there's so much going on and so many great quotes in the movie, but one of the things I want to talk to you about that I think probably had a formative influence on the way you know, we talked about this a number of times, including last night, introduced physical jeopardy into these films, is you were an animator on a film that I still think is one of the most harrowing films I've ever seen, Plague Dogs.
Yeah, and not very many people have seen it.
It's truly a terrifying movie that still gives me nightmares from time to time.
Yeah.
But it's also a film that I think is kind of a formative influence on you in the way that it introduced danger, physical danger to animation.
Well, I liked the fact that it was something different. And at the time that it was made, you know, having an unusual kind of animated film was even rarer. And it was done by Martin Rosen and Nepenthe, and they did Watership Down, which a lot of people saw. But it was the next film after Watership Down, yeah.
And it was that interesting period in the early 80s when there were lots of films that were out to change the feel of animation and make animation for feature animation for adults. There was Plague Dogs and Watership Down and The Secret of Nim, all these films that were, I think, an unusual period in animation. And it feels like that influence of those kinds of films we see in your work.
Well, maybe, but I probably would say that the things that really influenced me came before that, but they were.
Did you
get
a chance to act on those influences in those films?
Yeah. Well, the thing I liked about Watership Down and Plague Dogs, well, especially Plague Dogs, is it was done in the Bay Area, and that's something I always wanted to come up to the Bay Area and be part of that film scene. It was a small scene. You know, there weren't that many people up there, but it was really great films. I mean, it was, George Lucas is up there and Francis Ford Coppola and
Phil Kaufman
and Carol Ballard and John Cordy and all those guys were up there, you know, Matthew Robbins and Hal Barwood.
With whom you worked on Batteries Not
yes,
Included.
Yes, right. And so they are kind of known for making Hollywood-friendly films that had their own edge, though, and were a little more offbeat and without being distancing. And you know, that run of films, and it also saw Zantz was up there, and you know, so Amadeus, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, all of these movies were coming out of that area.
And the Pacific Film Archive was there, too, so lots of great films to see up there.
There you go. And actually, movies kind of started up there with Edward Muybridge. You know, a lot of people don't know that, so, you know. Good on the Bay Area. And I didn't, I got up there trying to do The Spirit with Gary Kurtz, who produced the first two Star Wars movies, you know.
You're going to do Will Eisner's Spirit.
Yeah, and I spent years trying to do it as an animated film. And we couldn't get anybody to finance us, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And at the time, we were told no one will ever make more than $50 million with an animated film, and only Disney has a shot at that. And so that's the kind of, yeah, I know. That's the wisdom of Hollywood once again.
But it's funny because with something like The Spirit, which is a comic book character who doesn't live in a comic book world.
Right. Well, and the weird thing is people assume because of The Incredibles that I know a lot about superhero comics, and I actually don't. You know, they start going, is that scene in Incredibles influenced by issue 37 of Aquaman? Where, and I go, I have no idea what you're talking about, you know? I read a couple of them, but I was really more of a TV and movie guy. So I got my superhero secondhand, like, you know, the reruns of the George Reeves Superman and the Adam West Batman. And so I was more influenced by spy films. The only comic strip that I know cold that's not funny, like Schultz or you know, Peanuts or BC or something like that, was The Spirit. Like, I can sit down and talk to you about The Spirit because I know all the Eisner's ones, and I know when he went into the Army and all that stuff, because to me, The Spirit is kind of the Citizen Kane of comic strips.
And it was said that Orson Welles was influenced by some of the way that the Eisner used light.
Oh, really?
Spirit, absolutely. That he was, in fact, it's been said he was a reader of The Spirit.
Wow.
He was an Eisner fan.
Yeah, so, and I think Eisner was a Citizen Kane fan.
You can definitely tell from the lighting in that.
Yeah.
But again, that was, unlike many other comics characters, there was that aspect of neighborhood, but also the aspect of physical danger. And these are things that both themes that we can find in your work, can't we?
Yeah. Hopefully, yeah. And, you know, I was all prepared. Jerry Reese and I were going to do The Spirit. And, you know, a lot of people were unhappy at Disney at that point, a lot of the young animators. And we didn't have contracts. And so a lot of really great people like John Musker and Glenn Keane were ready to leave Disney at 2 weeks' notice if I got financing. And they all did a little bit of work on The Spirit on the side, sort of.
Well, it's so interesting about The Spirit and what you do is one of the things that runs through your work is transformation. And we look at how the protagonist's life has changed when he gets the robot in Iron Giant, or how in the first Incredibles, I'm sorry, The Incredibles, forgive my imprecision, how Bob's life has changed when he gets to be another kind of superhero and loses weight, or in Ratatouille when Alfredo is transformed by having Remy cook for him,
right.
Or what happens here, we can say it a little bit, that Helen sort of takes center stage here, and she's transformed in physical terms, but also she gets to take center stage too, how these transformations take them away from who they really are and how dangerous that transformation is.
Well, and in The Spirit, it happens because he is presumed dead, and he decides to take advantage of that, and he actually has his lair is under the cemetery, which I thought was ultra cool. So, you know.
Under Wildwood.
There you go. Yeah.
I told you, I'm a spirit guy.
Oh, well, if you look, Glenn Keane did a wonderful animation interpretation of Dolan, Commissioner Dolan. And then he kind of, that design found its way into, I think, Oliver and Company or something like that. There's a character that looks
like Dolan. Yes.
And I kind of went, Glenn, you know, what are you doing, man? And he's like, well, you know, I liked it. And, you know, anyway. So, it's the film that didn't happen.
We're talking about movies other than Incredibles 2, but we'll get to that eventually, the writer-director.
Please, let's do. That's the one we made. Let's not keep talking about the one we didn't make.
Well, I'm just trying to talk you into making that, because you just remind that great line of Jules Pfeiffer's that he was one of, as you know, he was one of Will Eisner's ghosts, and he said he'd been making Eisner for so long that by the time he went to work for him, he could sign Eisner's name better than Eisner could.
Wow, that's cool. Well, Pfeiffer's amazing.
He is, and, you know, it's probably one of the reasons that Bob Iger owns Marvel is because his uncle was Will Eisner's partner.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, I did not know that. See, you learned something on The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell.
No, you don't, but I want to get back to that what transformation does, the idea of becoming a success by yourself is dangerous, a dangerous thing in all these movies that you've made.
That transformation is dangerous?
No, transforming and becoming a success by yourself, being taken away from what you are,
yes,
is a dangerous thing.
It is. You know, I think that work is a wonderful expression, and it gives you a sense of value. And if you're doing work that you don't believe in, I think it starts to extract from your soul. I mean, that's sort of in the first Incredibles. that's sort of what it shows with Bobbin and Shuricare. You know, here's this crowded room. He's in the one cubicle that has a giant column in it, so he doesn't even get a whole cubicle. And the whole point of the insurance company is to help people, and he's basically being told constantly, don't help people. We won't make money if you actually help people. And it frustrates, you know, that's the worst thing for a superhero. So, I kind of believe that work is one of the things that feeds you and saves you, you know?
But this idea of being taken away from what you are and sort of be transformed into something that's not you.
Right.
It happens to Helen here.
Sure.
It happened to Bob in that film. It happens again with Remy and Alfredo in Ratatouille. I just think that's such an interesting idea.
Linguini,
yeah.
Yeah.
Is Alfredo.
But you're the only one that calls him Alfredo. That's kind of cool.
I'm sorry about that, but yes.
You know too much.
Nobody's ever said that before. Let's sort of get this out of the way. But I think that idea of being changed and sort of getting this gleam of like success and how that can kind of be ruinous to people.
Sure.
Because it takes you away from family in so many ways. And family is so important in all these movies.
It feeds you. And I was so worried when I was coming up with the idea for Incredibles that I would I desperately wanted to get on through the gate, the iron gate that keeps you from making films. But I also thought if I ever got let in, it would demand all my time and I would stink at it unless I became a bad father. And I didn't want to stink at that either. In other words, if I got my golden opportunity and I didn't go 100%, that I might fail at it. And if I went 100%, I would not be as present as a father as I needed to be. So that kind of anxiety kind of is all over The Incredibles, even though it's out on the outside, it's a superhero adventure.
But that anxiety of not being able to come through for your family.
Right. I mean,
again, it's in all these features that you've made.
Right.
And I just find that to be a really interesting idea that
you're making me feel like I'm not somehow coming through for my family right now. I need to leave and go hug someone.
That wouldn't be the first time somebody's going to leave the show halfway through. But I just think I think it's a really interesting, it feels like the kind of anxiety that I would append to dramatic films more than live action film rather than animated film.
Huh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so animation loves being adult. And that doesn't mean that it stops being playful. It just means that it doesn't have to go, woogie woogie bunny, you know, let's go, you know, be pastel for a while.
But the great animation has an anarchic spirit,
yes.
That is much more adult thing. I mean, all those Warner shorts are best were... And then they were never really made for kids in the first place.
Right. They were made for the audience that was prepared to see the next Bogart film or the Bette Davis film. And, you know, I found out, you know, as a kid, you know, I loved Quick Draw McGraw especially. And I didn't figure out until years later that Michael Maltese wrote those. And he wrote of the best.
But it's Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Yeah.
All the great
Warner
shows. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so it's like, you know, that's where El Kabong came from. It was Michael Maltese's Kabong.
Oh, we could like go way deep with this.
Oh, yeah.
And talk about,
we need to talk about Incredibles, too.
We should do that before I get into talking about how Bob Kane created Courageous Cat.
Well, all right. Let's not go there.
You know what?
We're backing off. Incredibles 2.
Incredibles 2.
Coming to a theater on June 15th.
Yes, and apparently it's going to be at many, many theaters. Tell me what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. Well, now we've got all the what we might call the extraneous stuff out of the way. My guest is Brad Bird, whose new film is Incredibles 2. There's more to come. I promise we'll talk about the movie. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're talking about Incredibles 2. It's writer-director Brad Bird is sitting across from me, but so I can get back into some of the things I was talking about. I mean, we can see all these influences on you really bubble up in Incredibles. You're talking about spy films, and there's a character, Winston Devere, voiced by Bob Odenkirk, who looks like looks almost like Sean Connery in some ways. He's got that long, I mean, he's almost like the suits are cut in the same tailor, but he also looks a little bit like a Bond villain.
We wanted him to look a little bit sharky. Not in a nasty way, but in a smooth way, in the way that kind of cuts through the water and might be lethal, but isn't particularly, you know.
He almost suggests George Sanders in some ways in terms of the look.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. That's the first time I've heard that. But I was so happy that we got Bob. He was my first choice, and he's a wonderful actor.
And one of the things I mentioned to you last night, and you actually were able to extrapolate about this, is a great scene between Catherine Keener, who plays a sister, and Ollie Hunter, who voices Elastigirl Helen, that they're basically just talking about personal politics. And you just realize you're listening to the voices. You're actually watching a scene being acted out by two adults talking about adult concerns in the middle of a movie that people might presume is a kid's cartoon.
Presume, but is not.
And it reminded me of that scene you're talking about, and you actually mentioned it later on. There's a scene early on in The Incredibles with Sam Jackson and
Bob just talking in the car. Yeah. Well, a lot of people think that, I mean, even people in animation think that a good animation scene, a good scene for an animator to do, is something where somebody's doing something physical and they're being zany and they're moving around a lot. And that neglects the idea that animators are the really good character animators are actors, and they want to have something interesting to perform. And that can be two people in a car talking about old, adventures, where Frozone is talking about, Baron von Ruthless and how he's monologuing instead of finishing Frozone off. And, it's like two old kind of war vets talking about previous battles. I wanted to write the scene because it's the kind of scene that I wanted when I was first, animating, professionally. And I was really gratified when I wrote the scene and we recorded it with Sam and Craig.
Craig T.
Nelson, who does Mr. Incredible, that other animators were like, I want to do that scene. Can I have that scene? No, man, I want that scene. And it was great because, there are two guys in a car talking, but animation can bring something unique to that live action can't quite do. And it's this distillation, it's the dance of a performance. And by selectively eliminating details and finding the things that are most important to see, animation can be very incisive in a way that's really, it's unbelievably pure if it's done well.
But in moments like that, what you realize is the transportative power of movies. Suddenly, you're not just watching a cartoon anymore, and I don't mean that to sound denigrating. You're watching a drama. You're watching characters talking. I mean, that scene between those characters and Incredibles could almost be out of a Howard Hawks movie. That could be something out of Red River, where people just talk about who and what they are.
Yeah, I love Howard Hawks, and I love that you said that. That's great. You just made my day. I think I should leave now. Thanks, everybody. Watch for Incredibles, too.
Well, I guess it's a real hurry to get out of here.
No, I'm not. I'm actually really enjoying this. Hang out.
You're the one. My guest, of course, is Brad Bird. We're talking about his new film, Incredibles 2. But there's so much going on. I mean, it's such a complicated movie in the best way possible. And you do go from that kind of free-spirited, bouncing around, antic cartoon violence to a scene that, as I've mentioned to you, I think is one of the most extraordinary pieces I've ever seen in an animated film. It's a real action sequence. And I thought of this
brutal. Yeah.
No, incredibly brutal and terrifying in the most primal way, just because there are black and white lights flashing in this. I mean, and the character is
Screenslaver and Elastigirl fight.
She's fighting for her life.
Right.
And I don't want to give too much away about how she's handicapped in the sequence, but it's an extraordinary piece of work and it's truly terrifying to watch.
Oh, thanks. Well, the animators were really good, primarily this animator, Tim, who did the animation. I mean, I worked with a great stunt designer, fight coordinator, named Rob Alonzo on Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, and Tomorrowland. And when we did this sequence, I wanted him to come up and consult a little bit with our animators and our storyboard artists and talk about what somebody who is crippled in the way that Helen is crippled in that scene, how they would fight effectively and what would they do. So the fact that it came off is really gratifying to me.
And she's, I don't want to give too much away, but she's disabled sort of body part by body part in a way that feels like almost something like out of a Hitchcock movie.
Right. Yeah. 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 Yes. And it's also interesting because if she gets a shock or electricity, you know how you kind of go limp? Well, she's Elastigirl. So when she goes limp, it turns into this floppy thing that's useless, you know, and she has to kind of get feeling back into it while she's having the fight. So I really responded to scenes when I was a kid. There was this scene, I didn't see it on its original release, but I saw it on a re-release from Russia with Love. There's this fight between Robert Shaw and Sean Connery.
In really, really close quarters.
On a train. Yeah, yes. And it's brutal.
And loud.
And one of the things that Connery brought to the part that, with all due respect, Roger Moore couldn't do to save his soul was Sean Connery. You could see his life flash before his eyes. He was genuinely afraid he was going to die in these sequences. And I feel like Harrison Ford and Bruce Willis in Die Hard also picked up, you know, that baton that Connery, in my estimation, started in those films, where you can see that he's afraid. And that, instead of making him seem cowardly, it makes him more heroic.
And, because he's fighting for his life.
Right. And he is afraid, and somehow he's going to will himself out of it, you know?
Well, that, again, this is why I start with talking about Plague Dogs a little bit, but the idea of making sure there's a threat. And as I mentioned before, you start off The Incredibles with the idea of these characters being expendable, that they could die, because there's a whole sequence about a bunch of characters having died because...
In the first film.
Yes, in the first film. Right. That's what The Incredibles, I'm being very
specific. Yeah. You're good, man. You adjusted quickly.
I'm trying to pay attention here. But you start off your, if you pardon me saying this, mythology by showing that lives can be taken. And we shouldn't presume that people are going to live to the end of the movie.
Right. And that's one of the reasons I keep tipping my hat to Johnny Quest is a lot of people don't remember that it was in primetime when it first came on the air, that it was not aimed. People keep referring to it as a Saturday morning cartoon.
It was never that. It was Thursday night at 7:30.
Well, it was more that.
In reruns.
In its lifetime. Yeah, in its reruns.
But it originated as another primetime series, and there was no laugh track, a great score, and it was completely terrifying.
Yeah, and people died in it, and they did not come back, you know? And I loved that, you know? I loved the fact that it was willing to go there. And, you know, it was animated. So, you know, people might even see a hat tip or two to Johnny Quest and in Incredibles 2.
They might, or hear one, because we were talking about Hoyt Curtin last night. See, I can do all this stuff. It's really sad.
Man. You're jamming.
Again, I'm just paying attention. Take my lead from you. Even in something like Johnny Quest, there is this idea of people being expendable because Johnny's mother isn't there.
Right.
So there's
and already... that's why he has a bodyguard. You know, which is Ray Spannon, you know, yeah.
So that idea of danger.
Yeah, and how does Haji enter this series? His best friend, Haji, he saves Benton Quest's life by putting a wooden thing up when somebody throws a knife at Dr. Quest. So it's like, I love that. And when the business part of show business starts getting me, like, depressed and wondering why the hell I should be doing this, remembering my feeling when I saw that is what pulls me out of it, you know, and I go, oh, yeah, this is great. Like, if I see a bad movie or a movie that is made to prop up a quarterly report, and, you know, there are probably too many of those, I often go, oh, why even try? The movie business is tired. It's over. And then I go, wait a second, I know. And I'll play the opening 10 minutes to Once Upon a Time in the West. And it just makes me go, oh, yeah, movies are great. And, you know, they can be unbelievably cool. And, okay, I want to go to work again. You know, it's just, that's all I need. It's like, you know, those films where they show people having smelling salts. And they're yeah, okay, I'm ready to go again. I can go a few more rounds, you know.
My guest who's making all the right quotes here today is Brad Bird, whose new film as director and writer is Incredibles 2. We could talk about Once Upon a Time in the West forever as far as I'm
concerned. There you go.
That opening sequence where there's basically no dialogue.
Just the best thing ever.
But it's this idea of playing, and again, this is something that you really have found a way to use in animation is something we think about in live action, but having tones play off each other, where you're basically getting high comedy and melodrama in the same scene.
Well, yeah, you know, have you ever gone to like hear a rock band and they play up tempo stuff and you're bopping, and then three songs in they're still doing it and you're still bopping, and then it's like six songs and you're like, all right, man, you need to break it up, you know? It's like, come on, let's change the tempo. Filmmakers do that too, where they feel like they have to rat-a-tat-a-tat it all the way through. And pretty soon the audience starts to check out, which I really hate. And so I'm always trying to, in some way, even though I think Incredibles 2 is a fast-moving film, the tempo is changing constantly, somewhat. And I think that allows the audience to recalibrate. And every time they recalibrate, they're able to better receive whatever messages we are there to throw out. And I don't mean messages in terms of, like, this film is about the awkwardness of socialism, or, you know, it's more about the story of the characters in the film. You know what I'm saying?
No, I know it's about the awkwardness of socialism, but
I don't know what that means. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, I knew too, because the scene I was talking about with Helen and Evelyn is that scene, which is the scene where the movie kind of takes a deep breath after a lot's gone on.
Right, right.
And it gives us a chance to understand who these people are in very simple dramatic terms, rather than it being sort of keyed up just to draw attention to that thing you're talking about where the energy level is too high. Scenes like that and what you're talking about, varying the rhythm and the tone, is another way that, for me, you brought to bear the fact that you were not trying to top yourself with Incredibles 2, because so often in sequels you can see the effort to, I gotta make this bigger, I gotta like show all the money of everything being blown
right
up on
if there
screen.
Were 10 explosions in the first one, you had gotta have 20 or more in the second one. I think that I've seen too many good, I loathe this word, but I'll just say it because I can't think of a better one at the moment, franchises. Ah, it burns! Ah! I'm sorry. Okay. But I've seen people kind of trash their own thing because in order to do that, they start breaking it down mechanically and they start extracting from the soul of the original thing. And the strength of films, to me, in many ways, are its characters. And I think you have to say, how does this serve the characters? And how does this, you know, play with them and engage them and keep revealing new nuances with. It doesn't have to be tedious, you know. Character stuff can be fascinating, you know.
We're out of time. These things always go too fast, you Brad. Thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you. I love being on your show.
I love having you. My guest, whose new film is apparently about the awkwardness of socialism, is Brad Bird. The new film is Incredibles 2.
You know what I mean. It's
like I do now.
Film that, school teacher.
That clanking is the scales falling from my eyes. I learned so much about the human condition.
I'm tired. I need to go to sleep.
Of me, probably. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Leo DeLagula. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Pite, who's associate producer. Producer. I'm going back to Wildwood Cemetery. There. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.